Hello and welcome to our new episode of Risk and Regulation Unraveled, our Grant Thornton Financial Services podcast. This is the podcast that brings you conversations about the dynamic world of risk and regulation. We help our financial services clients understand new developments, upcoming changes, and how to stay ahead of the curve by inviting renowned experts to share their insights. I'm Alex Ellerton, I'm a partner in the Financial Services Group at Grant Thornton, and I'm your host for this episode. The financial services industry plays a central role in a world and an economy that are living through interesting times. With all the upheaval and uncertainties that this brings, governments, central banks and regulators look to effective regulation and risk management across the industry to ensure a stable base to drive growth for society and, by implication, for the financial services industry. Our podcast series will delve into the key trends and challenges for financial services, and in this episode, we take an in-depth look at the current key themes in banking and capital market sectors. Joining me today, please welcome my co-hosts Paul Garbutt and Ed Allen. Paul is a partner in the Financial Services Group and Ed is a managing director. And so welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Alex.
Hello. Thanks, Alex. Great to be here.
So without further ado, let's dive straight into the conversation, shall we? And a big picture one to start with. And perhaps Paul first, how are current economic trends influencing the strategic decisions of banking and capital markets institutions? And what approaches are being taken to navigate uncertainties and to capitalize on emerging opportunities?
Thanks, Alex. So I think the first thing to say is the trends as such in macroeconomic developments are, if anything, just uncertainty at the moment. What we're seeing and hearing from clients is there is no definite direction of travel. I think there's an optimism around at the moment generally that we are headed for a soft landing in the economy in the UK. However, there are clearly some headwinds from geopolitical events, and there's also the possibility that the interest rate cycle won't slacken as quickly as I think a lot of commentators and are now after Q4 starting to hope. So what does all that mean? It means that there is much uncertainty. There's no clear direction of travel. Banks are having to be prepared possibly for increased provisioning levels, possibly for recession or at least downturn macro events. And what we're seeing therefore is people trying as far as they can to keep lending to UK PLC. Certainly, we're not seeing anyone pulling back per se from lending markets, but in an environment where cost control is very much the king, everybody wants to focus on return on equity. Any free ride that people have enjoyed from interest rates is not expected to last any very much longer. And we're definitely seeing also a focus on capital and returns on capital. So a commonly held strategy that we're talking to our clients about will be to focus on those parts of their business that are not capital intensive. That typically means the wealth offerings and the asset management side that goes with it. So nothing endures but change, I feel, is the potted version of that one.
And Ed, what's your views on the same subject?
Certainly looking at the UK, credit conditions in the retail banking sector look under increasing pressure. The quarterly survey from the Bank of England suggested that this was the toughest quarter that banks are expecting to see in Q1 2024 since 2009 in relation to unsecured credit. Taking a broader view, last year saw a rebound in equity markets and there was a degree of profit taking, particularly in the tech sectors, which bounced back well. However, looking forward to this year, I agree with Paul, there is some degree of uncertainty. And I think just thinking about our banking clients and what we hear from them, last year was an uncertain year, to say the least. And that, you know, is something that I think most senior personnel within banks are taking a cautious view in terms of investments.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Paul. One of the things that we've talked about already there is interest rates. We've obviously seen some volatility in interest rates and inflation dominating discussion around the UK economy right now. So how do firms adjust in a time like this, and how do they make sure they continue to serve their customers? Perhaps go to Ed first on that.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, interest rates. Well, I think it's fair to say it's been a year of predictions that have been generally right in 2023. But looking forward into 2024, the expectation of a reduction in inflation is dependent on several key macroeconomic factors. We still have a high degree of political uncertainty globally. And looking at the UK economy, we've had 14 consecutive prints of interest rate increases. And we're at a point now where we're starting to see an inflection due to inflationary changes. Unfortunately, the last recorded inflation number for the UK in December suggested that things weren't moving as quickly as the government and commentators might have expected. But I think from a banking point of view, there is an expectation that net interest income is going to be under increasing pressure. There has also been, scrutiny over deposit rates at the retail end of the market. And we see there's a degree of competition around that side of the market in terms of the returns that are offered to clients. But to take a step back and look at inflation more broadly and interest rates, the global picture is somewhat, mixed. And I just pick out one sort of economy here, which has taken a completely contra view to the European and US, which is, of course, Japan. Japan has maintained low rates and is starting to see its economy with a focus on, the tech sector, of course, coming back into, strong equity performance. So there is a divergent strategy globally. And, that is, I think, creating some interesting opportunities for some of our global banking clients.
Thanks, Ed. And Paul, from your perspective?
Yeah, I'd echo what Ed said. The path of inflation and interest rates is not clear as we go through 2024. It may well be that interest rates and inflation are going to stay higher for longer than people expect, or it may not, unfortunately, is the simple reality of it. So what do we think firms should be doing about it? Well, what we're seeing is focused very much around any data on the recoveries and the collections side, any hint of arrears and missed payments. I think the clients we're talking with are very much on top of that side of their operation. I think, too, we're looking increasingly at some of the technical pieces around how firms are looking at their credit risk modelling and their provisioning levels. So we're seeing a focus on trying to reduce much of the manual intervention in those models and the numbers that they're generating to try and get back to a scientific or a pseudo-scientific basis for provisioning levels. We're certainly seeing that coming through as a theme. Be interesting, I think, as we go through results season to see what comes through as provisioning levels from the UK banks, particularly on their retail books. And also the other point in this will be the SME market, which we know some of the data coming through is suggesting that there's already an upward trend in insolvencies in the SME market. And it will be interesting to see how far that plays out as we go through 2024, if that starts to become a really important macroeconomic trend, or if it's just a gentle rise and a small blip as 2024 unfolds. So again, I'm going to repeat, it's very difficult to see what's going on, and definitely to echo Ed's point, we are seeing banks reluctant to invest and commit at this point to any particular direction of travel because there isn't a clear one emerging.
So all of this is about banks being clear on where the emerging risk lies, and We know that there are examples, well publicised globally, of when things have gone wrong. So if we look at things like the collapse of major institutions like Silicon Valley Bank, are the traditional banking organisations learning from this? And how do you think they will have to adjust from what they learn going forwards? And perhaps, Paul, come to you first on that.
Yeah, so I think it's tempting to deflect the Silicon Valley point as being an exclusively a US-based point, and in some ways a consequence of a local regulatory regime in the US as opposed to the international Basel regime, which is only applied to some of the larger US organizations. There was also, of course, pretty much coincident with Silicon Valley, we had the collapse of Credit Suisse. Again, specific reasons, I think, why Credit Suisse collapsed, but around the broader theme of, you know, a sequence of well-publicized risk management failures of one sort or another, I think, is generally accepted as the root cause around the Credit Suisse collapse. So I think what we're seeing then is a focus on risk management. We're seeing a focus on particularly liquidity and interest rate risk management coming through. 23, of course, saw the general uptick in interest rates and the consequences of that. UK banking should and seems to actually have quite strong interest rate risk management in place. I think, though, we do see a general trend from the UK regulators to challenge the banks around what they will do and what they can do as if events started to unfold against them. And we certainly are thinking that there could be failures from some of the smaller players in the UK market, perhaps not just the banks, but also some of the unregulated lenders as well, which you would anticipate as a consequence of, you know, provisioning, and particularly if the SME and retail market starts to get into trouble, if that is the scenario that unfolds. So I think reasonably we're seeing the regulators asking firms about what are their recovery and resolution plans, and are these actually really things that could be used as a playbook if things do turn against the some of those institutions.
Thanks, Paul. And Ed, picking up on this point, so how well do you think banks and regulators, central banks and government are aligned on staying in front of these trends to make sure that they are improving their resolution planning and resilience?
To answer the question in terms of alignment, I think certainly in the UK we see a consistent message from regulators on this topic, albeit that I think there's an increasing focus around liquidity risk management, and that's in different sectors of the banking community, from the smaller deposit taking institutions right the way through to, you know, obviously investment banks. Globally, I think that there has been some degree of, you know, perhaps focus in the US and continued focus on capital as a solution to this from regulators. Whereas I think in Europe and perhaps in the UK, the recognition is that liquidity risk management and recovery and resolution is perhaps more of an answer to some of these challenges that have been presented by the bank failures last year. I think one of the other points that's sort of coming through, and this needs to be reflected in liquidity risk modelling by banks, is just the speed with which these organisations got into difficulty. The classic sort of bank run scenario involving, you know, the withdrawal of deposits is now able to be sort of undertaken in such a short period of time. I think one statistic I saw is that Washington Mutual took sort of 14 days for many of their customers to be able to withdraw, you know, some of the key larger deposits, whereas with SVB and First Republic, online tools and so on allow people to extract those funds in incredibly fast time. And trying to sort of keep on top of indicators around uncertainty with regard to, you know, the liquidity position of banks is something that I think all parties need to sort of come together on. Yeah, I think conclusion, Alex, I think there is some coordination amongst regulators and the authorities. I think it's good in the UK, and we're seeing a consistent set of messages around liquidity risk management and recovery and resolution. But perhaps globally, there are sort of different views amongst regulators on this topic.
If I can come in on that, Ed, I think I agree with broadly what you're saying. I think there is a concern I'm picking up, though, that particularly with the consumer duty responsibilities coming through, questions such as deposit rates, retail deposit rates, are also, you know, beginning to hit some of the clients I'm talking with. And particularly for retail deposit rates, of course, historically, those would have been a matter for asset and liability management within the bank. Whereas if you start to impose a requirement to give the best outcome to depositors, you can start to quite seriously affect some of those asset and liability management models. And in other words, you end up with banks getting liquidity they don't really need, or you end up with banks pricing liquidity at a rate that doesn't necessarily make sense for their loan book. Are you seeing some of the same in the markets that you're looking at?
Yes, I think it's a short answer. I think in terms of deposit rates, it's an interesting systemic question when you start to look at what a bank does with its funding. And you know, of course, you can place it into the central bank, you can buy bonds, and we all saw what that meant with respect to the bank failures in the US. And you need to calculate a return in order to effectively support your clients' deposit needs. I think from a wholesale banking perspective, some of the provisions of Basel III, which came through in response to the crisis, like leverage ratio, net stable funding ratio, actually led to some changes in the way that institutional clients of banks dealt with deposits. And so liquidity risk management involved, you know, a portfolio type view, increasing use of money funds and other vehicles to try and place cash rather than just relying on unsecured deposits. That being said, calculating profitability on deposits is not an easy thing when you actually pull in all of the considerations within, as you say, an asset and liability model, and looking at certainly duration and other things starts to sort of impinge on what returns you can offer. So it's not as simple as saying this is the overnight rate that's being paid on central bank deposits, and therefore this is the translation cost of your sort of deposit rate that you provide to a client. I think that has to be broken down by type of client, type of institutional customer, and then obviously the business model of the bank. But equally, and one of the things we're probably going to get on to, thinking about, the competitiveness of the UK, financial sector, we do need to have a broad and competitive market. And that means, having different methods of generating good returns on your cash. All corporate treasurers and individuals will be looking at that. And, I've seen obviously the prevalence now of new providers in that space. So from traditional money funds right the way through to, alternative, deposit aggregators and other means of, both sourcing deposits and realizing better returns. And of course, right the way through to innovations like stablecoins. So I think this market is one which is seeing more innovation than we've seen in a long time. And perhaps this sort of, increase in rates and some of this pressure around optimization of returns is driving that.
So let's widen out the focus a little bit on risk management more widely. Risk management has been consistently a major theme for regulators and central banks over recent times. And in 2024, how do you see risk management practices evolving, and what lessons can be learned from these recent disruptions to make sure that resilience is enhanced in the future? Perhaps come to you first, Ed, on that.
Sure. I think the risk management frameworks within all financial institutions have been under, scrutiny from all stakeholders. So I include investors and regulators and customers. Certainly, the prevalence of some of these events has suggested that non-financial risk, that is the way that certain events, be those strategic risks or indeed operational issues, has become really, really important and is taking up a lot of time in the minds of senior executives within the firms that we work with. Some of the traditional disciplines, so market, credit risk, they still receive a high degree of attention. But as we sort of move into new ways of working, new business models, and of course, an increasing dependence on some really critical pieces of IT infrastructure, both within the banks and outside, from their service providers, there's a recognition that, you know, there's a more time and effort needs to be put into understanding these non-financial risks and how those get aggregated, measured, and incorporated into a wider risk management framework. That seems to be where, you know, more time and effort's being spent at the moment, Alex. And you know, I feel that, you know, over 2024, there's regulatory pressure and structure being put into this, but firms themselves need to have an effective framework for considering, identifying, measuring, and monitoring these risks.
And Paul, do you see this just being a continuation of the last number of months and years, or is there something more revolutionary at play?
I think it's largely evolutionary. We've got a trend, which I think will continue in 24, around that focus on the non-financial risks. I think with the classic risks, financial side, the market and credit most obviously, we are seeing more emphasis on data and data accuracy on some of those historic processes. So there's definitely a piece there that we're picking up on, and the amount of data that's required is increasing, just as the complexity of those models gets higher and those models get more embedded still into some of the workings of the banks. Of course, with the Basel rule changes, some of that takes away some of the regulatory benefits that you get from the credit market risk modeling that historically has been going on. But I think as a risk management discipline, it doesn't change the historic financial risk approaches. But I would say, echoing what Ed said there, what we're definitely picking up is much more focus around non-financial risks, and probably also, you know, combinations of risk types and better scenario analysis being required. So, you know, if one looks at some of the geopolitical landscape, modeling some of those geopolitical events, you've obviously got Middle Eastern tensions, Middle Eastern problems underway at the moment. Taiwan, China is a recurring piece for some years that I can't see is going to stop as a risk at the very least, that's going to be required to be considered by banks. So there are some quite serious pieces there. I mean, the other thing that you've got this year that's, of course, is well publicised when it comes to modelling for banks and their risk teams is the number of elections. We've got an election in the UK widely anticipated to come in 2024. And so you've got to try and anticipate what that might mean to the macroeconomic as well as some of the specific risk types that institutions will be looking at. You've obviously also got elections in the US coming up later this year. And again, trying to understand what that will mean for the UK banking sector, I think is a real exercise that people are starting to get their teeth into now, to look at some of the macro models, macro outcomes, and then model those through into what it would mean for the risk management within an specific institution.
So some truly global aspects there, Paul, and widening this out again further, even to some aspects for the planet as a whole. Sustainability and ESG, clearly a theme that we're talking to all of our clients about and have been for a while. For banks and capital markets firms, are those firms holding up their end of the bargain? How are they going to have to adapt their strategies to evolve to these changing societal expectations in this space? And perhaps, Paul, do you want to pick that up first?
Yeah, so yes, much going on in that space. I think it's made more complex by the fact that Europe is moving at a different speed to the US. And there isn't, therefore, a simple global pattern that one needs to look to. Much emphasis currently still around data provision and getting sensible data. That is very hard to crack, that particular nut, and we see a lot of effort going into that right now across the UK banking and capital markets sector. In terms of decision making and factoring ESG into decision making, I would say still the climate and the carbon cycle is probably still dominating that, but we are definitely seeing more being done now around both the S as well as the non-carbon elements of the environmental impact, biodiversity being the obvious one that captures all the headlines. But it still feels to me like it's a case of getting data on which to make proper decisioning is the challenge. To factor ESG, for example, into credit decisioning, yes, we see a lot of institutions are starting to move down that path. However, getting the data is where it quickly runs into a brick wall, as it were, of reality. And that's where we see the effort currently. A lot of interesting technology solutions potentially to come into play there. But I'll stop there. And Ed, what do you see?
I think if I was to sort of just focus on banking, similar to what Paul said in terms of wholesale banking, there's obviously an onus on banks to try and sort of extract information from their clients and sort of maintain that in an effective way. I actually think there's something interesting brewing in terms of this data point in relation to assets. So where somebody has an advantage in terms of going beyond the traditional sort of segments, say, for example, drilling beyond just agriculture as a whole, but into food production and trying to establish, you know, for example, the carbon capture capability of a particular piece of farmland using geolocation and other information on that, it can become really quite interesting and powerful. So rather than just casting agriculture and food production as a negative from a carbon perspective, trying to turn it into, you know, a positive, or at least doing that through data, is something that we'll start to see more of over the next sort of few years. And certainly, you know, it is an opportunity for new entrants who are specialists in some of these markets. In terms of the wholesale banking and more broadly capital markets in relation to this topic, I think there is, we've mentioned elections as political pressure in a number of jurisdictions around this point, and the perceived costs around the sort of climate transition and how that then translates into funding and financing costs for major, organisations is something that hasn't yet really sort of reached a sort of consensus in different economies. And I think the election in the US and what comes from that will be really quite significant. And we've seen, you know, this call is about risk and regulation. I think on the regulatory side, yes, there's inconsistency, but there's equally, I think, a focus around the misrepresentation of, environmental or social governance credentials of certain assets. And that's something that I think is also keeping, you know, our clients concerned at the moment in terms of how they go to market on some of these topics.
Thanks, Ed. And data and technology come across strongly in what you've both said around that subject. And it feels like in a podcast right today, you know, today we couldn't not mention AI and technology more generally, which is a landscape that clearly dominates headlines more widely. How do you see technological developments shaping the future of banking and capital markets? And what are the key things that we're likely to see straight away this year, do you think? And perhaps, Ed, do you want to pick that up first?
Sure. Well, as we're coming towards the end of the podcast, I thought I'd pull some more statistics out that are interesting. And I think ChatGPT is only 14 months old, which I think shows just how early we are in this journey, but also what an impact it's had already. Every one of our clients is taking this into their analytics and it, you know, the way that they look at both quality and efficiency. The interesting thing is that we see small components and tools being used in everything from processing to workflow enhancement, but equally, within the capital markets, we've seen the development of electronic trading and algos over the last sort of, 25 years, and that continues and expands into asset classes which haven't previously been as electronified. So for example, fixed income electronification is coming. Now, what AI presents is both a benefit and a challenge. The assumption is that this will sort of create an efficiency in the way that markets operate, but trying to constrain and understand and control and regulate the behavior of some of these tools is going to be, I think, a serious challenge for market participants and regulators. And, we all want efficient and, low cost access to financing, but it has to be done in a way which is fair and reasonable. So I think that's something that's going to be cause quite a lot of interest. And how do we interface, AI into the electronic trading markets? One thing I just wanted to raise, Alex, in terms of capital markets, was really important. We talked about sort of regulatory changes, the Edinburgh reforms in the UK, kind of under a degree of criticism in terms of, how much impact they've had and how, they seem to be going quite slowly. One area within one of the 30 or so reforms that package contains is the development of a consolidated tape for financial instruments in the UK, and that's coming in parallel in Europe. I think that's going to create some interesting additional data for both, asset holders and those that are looking to invest, as well as those that are looking to manage control and value positions. And that's something that should be coming this year if the reforms are implemented as intended. And that's something I think that's going to have a really significant underlying change in the financial markets infrastructure looking forward. I don't know, Paul, I mean, in terms of AI, we have lots of conversations around this topic. We see quite a bit of investment, but do you agree it's going to have as big a change as perhaps, commentators are saying?
So I think yes, it will do, but I think as ever with these things, it'll be a question of the timescales. So plenty of senior bankers I speak with are saying, yes, AI is going to change everything, but I just wish I knew exactly how and when. And I think that's the challenge here is it offers enormous possibilities, particularly in some of the work that probably used to require teams of more junior people, earlier stages in their career, typically going through researching, understanding things. I think AI can deal with a lot of that. I think we're likely to see, we already are, but even more generative AI being used in terms of customer facing and some of those, ever smarter chatbots type experiences. I think we can all expect to see more of that. And that's already a change that's underway. But what it will mean longer term for processing within banks, the way that infrastructure works, I'm not sure that there's a clear path forward on that side yet. That it will change, yes, but exactly how and when, I think, is not so obvious. And remember, we all talk about AI, but really there is, and there was before, even before ChatGPT 14 months ago, there was a clear trend in banking toward ever greater automation. The first bits generally were the client-facing pieces, which is where we saw more use of automation, more use of chatbots, apps, connectivity. But the reality is, for many of the, particularly the larger banks, they are still operating on platforms which are some years old. And one of the uses of technology that we're seeing is still around just how to get some of these legacy systems to talk to each other and to talk to risk management systems and clients in a more intelligent way. So there's still, I think, a lot to do at one extreme around AI forward looking and opening up a whole raft of new possibilities. But I think for a lot of our clients, there's still this reality of they're still held back by legacy systems and trying to get the latest technology to try and unpick and unpack some of the data they have and some of the capabilities that are lurking but buried by the legacy system. So it's a right mixed kind of piece. I think those that get it right clearly are going to win out in the next probably 10 years. Those that get it wrong are not. And there will be a piece here around how much budget people have got to invest. And again, those that do not have the budget to invest will suffer on a 10-year view. Probably points to M&A activity and all sorts of stuff again on that sort of longer timescale.
So maybe, Alex, I'll just sort of pick up on a couple of points that Paul said, and you know, you could argue we're maybe straying outside of our areas of expertise, and that's perhaps one of the key points that I'd highlight on this, which is senior managers need to understand the implications and use of these tools in order to be able to feel comfortable about their, you know, their implementation. Just touching on a couple of things that Paul said, certainly AI is accelerating the ability to code and code accurately. That's a real and present sort of improvement, which arguably is going to reduce costs for some banks, particularly around systems, probably beyond my skill set. But certainly, you know, I've heard that AI can just be hooked into mainframe systems and then manage the extraction and processing of data from them. But this requires a degree of faith from management in its use. And I think finally, you know, there's a lot of conversations about how AI could help with surveillance, transaction monitoring, and of course, controls around sanctions and financial crime. But these are fundamental controls for our clients and for the safety and security of financial markets. And of course, you know, our management in a position to be able to essentially bring these tools in a way which is going to you know, try and control such risks. And I think that governance, so senior management understanding and the governance frameworks in order to be able to approve and encourage the use of these tools is going to be key over the next sort of few years as AI takes hold. But it really does, it's an exciting time to be working in this market and with our clients. I mean, it certainly does feel like we're on the start of something particularly new and innovative on a number of fronts.
Yeah, I think Ed, you're quite right. I mean, it feels like we're about to hit a genuine paradigm shift in the industry. But I think, as with so many of these things, it will kind of build around a number of specific point kind of solutions, and then suddenly we'll wake up one day and realize that the world looks completely different, but we won't really understand how and when, perhaps.
Well, this was my first GT podcast, Alex, and of course now I'm nervous, because if we play this one back in a year's time, were the things that I said going to come to fruition, and do we have a completely different sort of set of outcomes from 2024 than Paul and I said? Well, I mean, that may be a test for us all to do a bit of a replay in 12 months' time.
Well, I'm signed up for that session already. Thank you both for some really great discussion. And it does feel right that we should finish on a real forward-looking subject that is full of exciting opportunity for financial services. And I'm sure we could continue this discussion for a number of hours. So thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. And we hope that you found the insight of our expert panel interesting. I know I have. Thanks to Paul Garbutt and Ed Allen for your views. And if you have enjoyed this discussion, please do subscribe to our Risk and Regulation podcast, which is available in all the usual places that you will download your podcasts. So I think all that leaves for me to say is thank you very much and goodbye.